Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom in crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to the Savvy Shrink. Welcome to the Savvy Shrink. My guest today, and we are so honored to have her here. Shahida Arabi is a summa cum laude graduate of Columbia University Graduate School, where she studied the effects of bullying across the life course trajectory. She is the number one Amazon best-selling author of three books, including Becoming the Narcissist's Nightmare, How to Devalue and Discard the Narcissist While Supplying Yourself, featured as a number one Amazon bestseller in three categories, and as a number one Amazon bestseller in personality disorders for 15 consecutive months after its release. Her most recent book, Power, Surviving and Thriving After Narcissistic Abuse, was also featured as a number one Amazon bestseller in applied psychology. She is the founder of the popular blog for abuse survivors, Self-Care Haven, which has millions of views from all over the world. Her work has been shared and endorsed by numerous clinicians, mental health advocates, mental health professionals, and best-selling authors. For her undergraduate education, Shahida graduated summa cum laude from NYU, where she studied English literature and psychology. She is passionate about using her knowledge base in psychology, sociology, gender studies, and mental health to help survivors empower themselves after emotional abuse and trauma. Her writing has been featured on Psych Central, The Meadows, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, The Huffington Post, Mogul, The Thought Catalog, and Harvard-trained psychologist Dr. Monica O'Neill's website. Shahida, welcome.
Thank you so much, Andrea. I'm so honored to be here.
Oh, it is. The honor is all mine. I'm so happy you're here. Our listeners are thrilled to have you here. And it's just wonderful to share this time to have a dialogue today that we're going to be talking about as relates to the impact of childhood trauma and the trauma repetition cycle with survivors getting into toxic relationships as adults. So just absolutely thrilled to have you here and for you to share your expertise. Could you say a bit more about this topic and how you see this issue impacting survivors?
Absolutely. I think this is so important to talk about because there's so many survivors out there who've not only been abused in relationships in adulthood, but in childhood. Yes. At the hands of, you know, toxic family members who are narcissistic or even sociopathic. And, you know, when society thinks of PTSD or the effects of trauma, we automatically, I think of war veterans, mm-hmm. but we forget children who grow up in war zones at home, you know, children who are verbally berated, emotionally terrorized, children who witness domestic violence, some who are even, you know, physically or even sexually abused. They too can get PTSD. They too can suffer the effects of trauma. And it happens at a time that's very vulnerable, right? Their brains are at a very vulnerable stage of their development. And so I find that childhood narcissistic abuse can actually be the root to the beginning of complex trauma. And as for the trauma repetition cycle, this pattern where the child who has undergone bullying and or parental abuse and then later endures abuse by intimate partners in adulthood, you know, that's one of our biggest issues because they've been subconsciously programmed to believe that they're unworthy. And they're searching for this rescuer, someone who is going to meet their unmet needs of childhood. But what they come across quite frequently is someone who reenacts their childhood wounding and actually adds on to their existing trauma, right? And I just want to talk a little bit more about how complex trauma survivors suffer lifelong effects, because it's not just limited to the effects of physical abuse. You know, research has proven time and time again that parental verbal aggression can actually rewire the brain. And, you know, to quote the brilliant Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, our brains can literally be rewired for fear. You know, our amygdala, which controls our fight or flight response, which controls our emotional regulation, our moods, it becomes hyperactive and enlarged as a result of trauma. Our hippocampus, the part of our brain that deals with learning and memory, shrinks due to trauma. And our prefrontal cortex, you know, which has a lot to do with our executive functioning, our decision making, our judgment, that's affected as well. Trauma actually causes cortical thinning in the brain. So the reason I'm talking about this is because I just want to drive home the point that the brains of children at this stage are so malleable, and the effects of, you know, chronic emotional and verbal abuse, let alone physical abuse, it leaves a mark beyond childhood, right? It enters into adulthood and it becomes complex trauma where we end up carrying this pervasive sense of toxic shame, self-blame, and we struggle with emotional flashbacks that regress us back into the site of the original trauma. And we have this very active inner critic that resembles the voices of our early childhood abusers. And so what I find is that childhood abuse survivors of narcissistic parents especially are programmed to self-destruct because they're conditioned to believing that they're worthless, that they're defective, and their boundaries have been so eroded and they're almost non-existent that they tend to engage in people-pleasing behavior. They walk on eggshells. So really the first 18 or so years of, you know, a childhood abuse survivor's life, being raised by these toxic parents can literally change their life course trajectory. And some survivors end up having to heal from a lifetime of chronic abuse as a result of just having even just one narcissistic parent. So I definitely do think that there's some form of trauma reenactment involved when you've been through this type of trauma in childhood. And I can personally say I've been through it myself, and I've heard from so many survivors who've been through it as well.
Wow. You speak so eloquently, and I think you hit the nail on the head. And I know a lot of people are fortunate enough to read your writings and to follow your coaching programs, which we'll talk more about at the end of the podcast. But you just hit the nail on the head, weaving in trauma theory in with narcissistic abuse recovery. And I completely agree, having that blueprint or sort of the an impression, so to speak, of having that kind of toxic environment really sort of sets the stage for many to have that sort of what we call the repetition cycle, a trauma repetition cycle in future relationships. It can, and it often does. And I think you've just beautifully described for our listeners how this happens. And because we're in such a wonderful age of modern technology and neuropsychology, fortunately, there are researchers like Bessel van der Kolk out there that are researching how can we help people heal from this.
And absolutely, you
know, it's great that you're writing so eloquently and prolifically about this and offering hope for listeners, and also, you know, tangible evidence-based research that's out there that can be accessible to survivors. So it's a blessing that you've been able to create lemonade out of the lemons in your circumstances. And it's truly an honor to not only hear your theoretical framework upon this and your research and writing about it, but also how you help your coaching clients and how you as a survivor have been able to connect with thriving. We'd love to hear your theory also on how being exposed to narcissistic family systems or bullying, like in the school environment, can in essence create sort of a blueprint or familiarity with toxic or narcissistic people later on in life. Do you see this sort of thing happening with your coaching clients?
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. And I definitely see this with so many survivors who are suffering from complex trauma, you know, as a result of being raised by a malignant narcissist, or, and then they, you know, become re-violated by multiple predators in adulthood. And I think that there's a couple of theories that I have on why this happens. The first one is a bit more biochemical and biological. So we talked about how the brain is affected during early childhood trauma. And obviously that creates certain attachment styles towards predators, as well as very heightened emotional responses that I think that abusers pick up on and exploit. But what we also have to remember is that our bodies have literally been keeping the score on this war zone that we've had to go through as children. You know, our bodies are so accustomed to the chaos of crazy making that we find ourselves more intensely attached and trauma bonded to partners who tend to replicate a similar chaotic effect on our bodies as our narcissistic parents, because we had a new normal that was very different from from children who were raised in healthier households. So we feel biochemically attracted to those who might resemble the dysfunction of our early childhood abusers because they mirror the severe highs and lows that our bodies and minds went through in childhood. And when you think about it, narcissistic parents aren't all that different from narcissistic abusers in relationships. They love bomb their children when they need something from them. They triangulate them with other siblings, pitting them against each other. They devalue them with hypercriticism, rage attacks, verbal and emotional abuse and put downs. And they engage in intermittent reinforcement as well, merging this sort of cruelty with affection at critical periods and withdrawing that affection, giving them crumbs to make them hope that they'll receive that love and approval and validation that they always desired. So when we think about the realm of relationships in adulthood, there's all sorts of chemicals being released when we're in a bond with a predator in adulthood. Dopamine, oxytocin, adrenaline, cortisol, and even our serotonin levels are being affected. And these are all involved in attachment, trust, fear, and stress. And they create this very powerful bond that's actually strengthened by intermittent cruelty and affection. So I have this whole chapter in my book, Becoming the Narcissist Nightmare, really dedicated to talking about this biochemical addiction, because we really do have to detox, not just from, you know, the abusive partner, but from a lifetime's worth of abuse when we're complex trauma survivors. And the effects of intermittent reinforcement really work well with our reward system to create this addiction, because, you know, dopamine flows more readily to the brain when there's this inconsistent schedule of rewards, when we don't know when our next fix is coming. We don't know if our abuser will be nice or callous, whether they'll be Jekyll or Hyde. And that actually strengthens the reward systems in our brain. And it causes us to become addicted to these types of abusers that are so familiar to us because we've been raised by similar types of toxic people in childhood. And another thing that I want to mention is Dr. Helen Fisher, who has done a lot of research in this field about biochemical addiction, talks about how the brain of people in adversity-ridden toxic relationships actually resemble those of cocaine addicts. Wow. So really, toxic love for us is a drug addiction. And, you know, these chemical bonds all come into play in a relationship with a narcissistic abuser in adulthood. And because we're so already accustomed to it, for us, a normal, healthy relationship may feel very unfamiliar, and it may even feel a little bit disturbing. And it can create a lot of resistance because we don't know what to do with someone who doesn't fall in line with that instability and dysfunction that we're so used to. Yeah. And it might even feel a bit boring, honestly, because our bodies are so attached to that.
Yeah.
And we learned as children to associate betrayal with love. We were conditioned to see abuse as a form of connection. And in fact, it was the only form of connection offered to us. So survivors of narcissistic parents have this extra layer of healing, I think, to undergo because we have to unlearn all these unhealthy belief systems, but we also have to clear our bodies and our minds of its familiarity with toxicity. And complex trauma survivors, as Judith Herman, another fantastic expert on trauma, has said, are in this repeated search for a rescuer. So I think even besides the biochemical bonding, we're also subconsciously trained to seek validation. And narcissists on the onset present us with a lot of it in the love bombing stage, right? And so that's very, very tempting to us to finally meet our childhood needs when we are being love bombed by a narcissistic predator in adulthood. And again, I just want to emphasize this isn't our fault. It's just the way that we've been wired. And I want to acknowledge how sick it is that a, you know, a predator like this chooses to prey on those who've already been traumatized. This is a reflection of them, not us. You know, we can certainly acknowledge our agency in healing, but in no way are we ever at fault for the abuse or the predatory actions of others. I mean, none of us ever consciously choose to be with an abuser. And anyone, regardless of their trauma history, can really be duped by a narcissistic predator. It's not just people who are childhood abuse survivors who are susceptible to narcissists. But I do think those factors definitely play a role.
I think you're so spot on, so eloquently stated. And I think our listeners will absolutely resonate because this is truly the case for so many, that what you describe as that blueprint in the family system can definitely create the biochemical framework, but then the conditioned belief systems, as you just described, that sort of prime someone for a sort of abusive or predatory kind of relationship. And I love the fact that you are so empowering for survivors and, you know, really remind our listeners that it no one is to blame for abuse, regardless if it happened in family of origin or a love relationship or even a work relationship or bullying on the playground. And I think you also make a good point as well that people who haven't had narcissistic abuse in their family of origin are also susceptible to the predation of a narcissist or even an extreme narcissist, like a malignant narcissist or a psychopath. A lot of people, such as when we talk about high empathy or high emotional IQ people, those folks can be singled out and targeted by predatory people because of their emotional IQ and empathy as well. And many people who have been raised in narcissistic family systems have developed high emotional IQ. But, you know, I think regardless of background, anybody who has some of those qualities of high compassion, high empathy, the ability to reciprocate, compromise, authenticity, integrity, those are the very qualities that a predator is lacking. So they want to
Absolutely.
Yes. You've done a beautiful job of describing how survivors can really have that blueprint in place. How can they learn to protect themselves from being drawn to toxic significant others or friendships or maybe a toxic work environment? What can survivors do to protect themselves and have that kind of invisible shield?
So I think if you're dealing with a lot of abusive relationships in adulthood, I think a period of being single is absolutely essential because our bodies have to return to this baseline level of safety after being in this war zone for so many years, and we have to readjust biochemically to stability. You also need to learn how to survive being alone so that if the time ever comes where you do meet another predator, you'll run that much faster in the other direction. Or at least your bond to them won't be as strong as it was when you were significantly drawn to them due to your childhood wounding. And you also prefer your own company over any form of toxicity. And, you know, I don't just mean being single and just relationships. You may also want to hold off on establishing close friendships during the time immediately after being in an abusive relationship, because predators can come in the form of false friends. And many survivors actually find that they were invalidated and re-traumatized because there were actually a lot more toxic people than they thought in their lives. I find that especially true for complex trauma survivors is when they're waking up from narcissistic abuse and learning more about what's happened to them, they uncover that there's a lot more toxic people in their lives than they originally thought. And so those people, you need to also be able to detach from them during your healing journey as well. And a symptom of abuse that we don't often talk about is self-isolation. You know, survivors are isolated by their abusers, but they also tend to withdraw socially. And so there's this period of hibernation that takes place. And during this time, you can actually take advantage of building your own internal resources and coping strategies and boundaries. I'm not saying to isolate yourself from, you know, professional support, because you obviously need that after an abusive relationship, or nourishing support networks like survivor communities, but just carve out some time to get to know yourself, rebuild your life, become more steadfast in your boundaries. And I think that's the way to really begin differentiating between authentic connection and, you know, the sort of excessive love bombing or flattery or crumbs that a narcissistic abuser feeds us. Because again, like to a childhood abuse survivor, when they've been deprived of affection and love for so long, to them, any form of unhealthy, toxic love can look like a loaf of bread when in actuality, it's crumbs. And in terms of healing the body and the mind, I always recommend that survivors work with a trauma-informed counselor such as yourself, you know, who understands the dynamics of covert emotional violence, who understands personality disorders, and who can help them safely address and process their traumas. Some survivors might benefit from therapies like EMDR, the emotional freedom technique, cognitive behavioral therapy. It really depends on each survivor's needs. But when they've been severely traumatized like this, they really do need to work with a licensed professional to safely navigate their triggers. And to supplement that, I found that through both my personal experience, research, and survivor accounts, that a daily meditation practice, yoga, and exercise can help heal the same parts of the brain affected by trauma. And it can actually provide this healthier source of addiction to the toxicity of unhealthy love. You know, meditation has been proven by research to decrease gray matter density in the amygdala, which, as we talked about before, plays a huge role in, you know, flight or flight, anxiety, stress. It increases gray matter density in the hippocampus, where learning, memory, self-awareness, and self-compassion are involved. And again, this is the area of the brain that actually shrinks due to trauma, and it thickens the prefrontal cortex, which, as we talked about, is, you know, has that cortical thinning due to trauma. But when you meditate, you know, that actually becomes thicker. So all of these, you know, self-help supplemental strategies actually rebuild our brain in the same areas affected by trauma. So we can actually rebuild our brain to the point where it might not be, you know, in a pre-trauma state, but it's going to have a lot of post-traumatic growth, right? Mm-hmm. And again, to tackle that biochemical addiction, in my book, Becoming the Narcissist Nightmare, I talk about how survivors can actually find alternative ways to getting that rush mm-hmm. without the narcissistic abuser, without any sort of abuse or toxicity in our lives. And we can do this by, you know, challenging ourselves to try new things. And that can be as extreme as skydiving, to taking a very small risk and going out doing something that you don't normally do, mm-hmm. which gives you that adrenaline rush without that toxicity. You can create nourishing support networks, which allows those oxytocin bonds that will help you, not hinder you. And you can engage in these pleasurable activities that have some form of novelty to them, that have some form of healthy risk. That allows you to stimulate the reward centers of your brain without engaging in any kind of abusive relationship. So these are just a few examples of, you know, how you can begin to substitute that unhealthy addiction in a way that lets you actually thrive after abuse. Mm. And one more point that I just want to make about mindfulness meditation is that it can also be extremely helpful to remaining no contact with your abuser, because you're learning how to radically accept rather than impulsively act on your emotions and urges, mm-hmm. right? You're able to react from a space of your intuition. So again, these are all strategies that you can use to become more mindful of your boundaries and rights, and to clear space so that you can sort of channel and process the trauma in a healthier way. And I just want to reiterate, it's not going to bring you back to a pre-trauma state. I don't think anything can, but mm-hmm. it'll still encourage a lot of post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, those are excellent suggestions. And I think you speak very specifically about what can be done for survivors that really want to work on rewiring their brain and all that held trauma in their body. So, you know, all of those suggestions are fabulous. And it's a multi-layered approach to healing, and certainly those are suggestions that I would recommend to clients in my own practice. So it's mm-hmm. it's wonderful that you have been able to sort of be a participant observer in your own kind of research of this whole dynamic of healing and recovery and entering a place of thriving. So the suggestions that you offer would be for a complex trauma survivor that is either a survivor of a toxic family system or a relationship, like a love relationship with a toxic person, or even a work environment. It could exist in any of those life domains, or friendship. And mm-hmm. I think those suggestions are outstanding.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And once a person is in that zone of no contact and healing and going within and approaching their healing sort of from a multimodal perspective, how does the survivor learn what is healthy in a relationship? Is that something that can be addressed in counseling? Can it be addressed in life coaching? Do you recommend that survivors start with psychoeducation and reading? What would be your recommendation in terms of understanding what's healthy and what isn't? Because so many people just don't know. Ironically.
Right. I think all three, honestly, can okay. be applied. I think it's not one or the other. I think okay. you definitely do have to work with a counselor to safely navigate your triggers, start mm-hmm. to clear out the trauma to make space for new empowering beliefs. You can also work with a life coach to help you stay no contact. And I think even having a support network of survivors, a healthy support network, because, you know, you want to vet your resources as well mm-hmm. and make sure that the support community that you're relying on is a healthy one and empowering one. I think that it's really important to start creating a list of boundaries, recognizing your human rights. And that might seem rudimentary, but it's often very essential and an eye-opening exercise for anyone who's been traumatized since they were a child. Trauma therapist Pete Walker actually has this great article on his website called The Human Bill of Rights. Mm. I think that's a great place to start to think about what are my rights and how have they been violated in the past?
Yes.
And what can I do to make sure they're no longer violated? You know, and make your own list of things that have made you feel small in the past, because those things should not be allowed in your life, whether that be insult, infidelity, gaslighting, projection. I mean, these are all forms of aggression and you don't deserve it. And it's so important that you make this list so you can start to create a counter narrative, a reverse discourse of what you actually deserve and mm-hmm. what you have a right to. And creating this reverse discourse also means that you're going to basically fight against all the things that your abusers have instilled in you about yourself and your potential. You know, we've talked a lot about this, about how narcissistic abusers are very pathologically envious. Mm-hmm. So that's even part of their DSM criteria, that they're envious of others. And so they will try to ingrain in you and instill in you these harmful beliefs about yourself and your potential. And there are ways to kind of rewire your brain so that you're no longer hearing your abuser's voice. You know, mm-hmm. I'm a huge, huge advocate of positive affirmations.
Good.
But even before that, I think, you know, space needs to be cleared out for them. So process mm-hmm. the trauma, create that space, and then fill it with those affirmations, fill it with these new empowering beliefs about yourself, create this new narrative, you know, write your new story. And again, it's a process. So don't ever expect perfection or an instantaneous end result. You know, I can say personally, like, I've done a tremendous amount of inner work, but I still have so much left to learn. And the journey is always bringing me, you know, new challenges. And I think for complex trauma survivors, what happens is that as they go through life, there are certain wounds that will come up at certain points. And, you know, it's going to take time for you to uncover all of those wounds. It's not going to happen all at once. Healing is not linear, it's cyclical. So things that you thought were healed may come up again, and you might still meet people who are predators. It's not going to make you immune to meeting people who are predatory, but you'll have new empowering beliefs to help you detach from them at an earlier state. Hmm. And I also think finding positive role models too is very important, you know, whether that be, you know, a counselor, an advocate, a friend. Find examples of the type of healthy relationship that you are looking for in the future, or healthy friendship, and emulate whatever qualities you see in your relationship with yourself first, right?
Good.
Create this sense of self-trust and be gentle and compassionate towards yourself and your own healing journey.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding suggestions. Boy, our listeners are so lucky to hear your words of wisdom. Outstanding. And I think you just spelled it out for them beautifully. So I'm not even going to elaborate or expound upon that, because I think it's just fantastic information. And I love the fact, again, as I've mentioned, that you're so strength focused and empowering in your writing and in your support of survivors, because so many survivors feel to blame, as we said just mm-hmm. a few minutes ago, for the narcissistic abuse they've experienced, whether it's family of origin, love relationship, work, friendships. Oftentimes, survivors have been mislabeled or misdiagnosed. Mm. And I have a lot of clients that come into my practice that say that they have been mislabeled as codependent or some other label that mm-hmm. may or may not be applicable, and in many cases is absolutely not applicable and is rather victim-shaming or blaming.
Mm-hmm.
You feel that this common label, codependent, is a helpful label for survivors?
I think that, you know, some survivors and even society as a whole, they find relief in this codependent label because it provides them this shorthand way of describing maybe the behaviors that they engaged in the abusive relationship. But I think sometimes the codependent label can be taken way too far to dismiss mm-hmm. what I think is the real issue in an abusive relationship, which I think is trauma bonding, you know?
Yes.
Codependency places the blame of the abuse on the victim, when in reality, you know, the victim is not an enabler, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can be a victim of abuse, regardless of whether or not they define as codependent. And historically, I mean, the codependent label has it was a term related to the caretaking and enabling behavior of partners of alcoholics.
Correct.
So I think that, you know, using it to apply to an abusive relationship, it can really complicate things where we're not really focusing on the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
And just to put into context for any listeners who may not be familiar with the term trauma bonding, you know, trauma bonding, simply put, is when a survivor develops this intense bond and attachment with his or her abuser through that traumatic experience of abuse. And, you know, there's usually some level of harm or threat to their survival involved, whether it's emotional or physical. And as a result of trauma bonding, there's this sense of ambivalence towards the abuser who acts as both the perpetrator and the hero, right? Because they're always sort of, you know, subjecting the victim to abuse, but then also throwing in crumbs of periodic affection, also rescuing them. And Dr. Joe Carver has this excellent article on trauma bonding called Love and Stockholm Syndrome, where he talks about the small kindness perception. You know, he says that abusers make sure to periodically throw in, you know, some gifts, some positive attention, or even false apologies to make the victim doubt his or her reality of the abuse. Mm. And when that happens, in the victim's mind, the abuser's small act of kindness becomes amplified because it happens so rarely, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the victim starts to see the abuser as the rescuer. And so they have that sort of ambivalence, and that trauma bond makes them dependent on their abusers for comfort and survival.
Sure. Well,
ironically, even though they're being abused by them in the first place, right? So it's basically they're giving medicine to the person they're making sick. So there's a stark difference, I think, between that form of dependence that is an effect of trauma and, you know, and codependence, you know, because when you have a victim who is dependent on the abuser, whether that dependence is primarily psychological, financial, you know, there's many ways to become dependent.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you need the abuser to survive. You've been conditioned to feel worthless.
Mm-hmm.
The abuser has fed you falsehoods about your capabilities and accomplishments. And so you're reacting or acting in maladaptive ways that are a result of the effects of trauma, not because you're codependent or an abuser yourself, but because you've been traumatized. You know,
mm-hmm.
Again, we all know this as survivors. You know, over time, abusers are able to chronically terrorize their victims to the point where they react. I mean, any normal human being eventually, you know, snaps after years of chronic abuse.
Of course.
So I'm not saying that there aren't survivors who aren't codependent, because I think that for a few survivors, they might feel that it's empowering to learn about codependency and addressing it. But I actually think that the first priority that we need to address as survivors is addressing the trauma bond, is addressing the effects of trauma.
Yes.
And I find that to break the trauma bond, you have to be able to grieve and honor the complex emotions that are going to arise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have so much ambivalence and so much cognitive dissonance about who the abuser tried to make you believe they were versus who they actually are. So in order to reconnect to the reality of the abuse, you have to get in touch with two important emotions that I think most of society vilifies and, you know, asks survivors to repress, which is anger and disgust. Now, survivors tend to be really afraid of their own rage. And there's a lot of rage after you've been abused, right? Which is understandable. But I think for complex trauma survivors, it's even harder to admit that you are angry because you've been taught to please others in order to survive since you were a child.
Mm.
So being able to acknowledge, honor, process that anger in a healthy way is so vital, I think, to the grieving journey, because anger is actually your pathway back to freedom.
Mm.
When it's used to honor yourself and your human rights, you know, your anger reminds you that you're a human being who's been violated, and this is the sort of outrage that keeps you separate and detached from your abuser. It can help you keep going on the no contact journey, you know. And I always recommend, if you have a lot of rage, obviously work with a counselor to connect to and process these emotions in a safe space and find healthier outlets for that anger. And make a reference list of either abusive incidents or even general statements that can reconnect you to the reality of the abuse. I call these reality check anchoring statements.
Great.
And, you know, they've been a lifesaver on my own journey as well. And it works because during the relationship, we've had to idealize our abusive partner in order to cope and survive. And now it's time to get reconnected to the reality. It's time to redirect it so that we're actually resolving the cognitive dissonance in the other direction, where we're actually reconnecting to the fact that our abuser was an abuser. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you find yourself romanticizing an abusive ex-partner, a family member, a coworker, a friend, whoever it may be, you can remind yourself of what they did, and it works to retrain your thinking patterns and shift them so that you start to feel more connected to your authentic outrage, and you can cut the cord and maintain no contact.
Great. Oh my goodness. That's so chock full of information, just wonderful pearls of wisdom that you're sharing with our listeners, and so helpful, because I think so many people are just really beset with this sense of culpability, that they feel that they're to blame. And everything that you say is not only empowering, but it's so fact-packed and just full of awesome psychoeducation that survivors really need to understand what the heck happened, whether it was in their family of origin or love relationship or both or what have you. I think half the battle is just really understanding what the heck this thing called narcissistic abuse is.
And, absolutely.
Oh my gosh, your literature and your writing is the best I've seen. It's
Thank you so much.
It is just so spot on. And, you know, people are very fortunate to be able to have access to all of your eloquent writings and words of wisdom. And I'm excited that they get to hear your wisdom as a, not only a survivor, but really an educator, a writer, a life coach. And you've just provided so much awesome information. And I do think that there really needs to be more said about trauma bonds versus codependency, because that is such a hot button item for so many survivors out there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great you've already written about it, you've already addressed it, and that there's hope. There's reason to be hopeful for survivors that, yes, this is difficult, this thing called complex trauma, but no one is to blame for it, except for the perpetrator, of course.
Absolutely.
Right. And the survivor has a lot of reason to be hopeful that they can heal. And they can not only survive, but they can enter a chapter of a life of thriving. It's just going to take a lot of hard work. But you're an example of somebody who's been able to walk that path of thriving and healing. And I just am so honored to be able to share this time with you today. And with that, if you could tell us a little bit about your work with survivors and what services you offer and where we can hear more about what you do, Shahida, it'd be awesome to have that information.
Absolutely. So I do no contact coaching for survivors on my website. You can visit it at selfcarehaven.org. My personal blog is selfcarehaven.wordpress.com. And there are a few different places where readers can find my work. I have a blog on Psych Central that I think childhood abuse survivors may find especially helpful. It's called Recovering from a Narcissist. And among my articles there are, I include a 5-part series on daughters of narcissistic fathers, the effects of childhood bullying, and really articles about how to recover as a complex trauma survivor. I also have an article on The Meadows on the effects of complex trauma and bullying. I write extensively for Thought Catalog and Huffington Post. So you can also find my work there under Shahida Arabi. And just to speak briefly about the books that I have available, my most comprehensive book, which you, Andrea, also contributed to, is Becoming the Narcissist Nightmare, How to Devalue and Discard the Narcissist While Supplying Yourself. I also have a new essay collection on narcissism called Power, Surviving and Thriving After Narcissistic Abuse. I have a book for younger readers called The Smart Girl's Guide to Self-Care. And for poetry lovers, I have a poetry collection for survivors of emotional abuse called She Who Destroys the Light, Fairy Tales Gone Wrong. And you can also visit me on Twitter at SelfCareHaven, Instagram Self-Care Warrior, and my Facebook page, The Smart Girl's Guide to Self-Care.
Fantastic. You are a wealth of knowledge and truly a voice of hope. And that is so essential for our survivors. Really appreciate your sharing your time and your wisdom and your expertise, and looking forward to learning what's down the pike for you, because I'm sure there's going to be more in the works for you in terms of not only coaching, but writing. And you're just right on it. It's just awesome. It's wonderful to hear your perceptions and your research about this as a survivor. And I know you're helping so many millions of people out there. So thank you so much,
Andrea. Absolutely. I was so honored to be here. And I just want to say that your articles are very life-changing as well. And I love referring readers to your work as a life coach and a therapist. You're just amazing.
Well, I so appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you. Thank you so very much, Shahida. And thank you again for sharing our time. Thank you, listeners, for being on The Savvy Shrink. And look forward to having you back sometime soon, Shahida.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.